On July 15, 1959, 500,000 steelworkers walked off the job, the largest single strike in U.S. history. Steel production, the lifeblood of American enterprise, ground to a halt. With an economic crisis looming and with the nation's industrial inertia at a standstill, weary eyes in the foothills outside of Pittsburgh turned to Braddock, Pennsylvania, an iconic steel town on the Monongahela River and home to a high school football team on the verge of greatness. Greg Nichols has penned a new book that looks at this time and this place. It's entitled Striking Gridiron, A Town's Pride and a Team's Shot at Glory During the Biggest Strike in American History. It's a great pleasure to welcome Greg Nichols to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, Jed, thanks so much for having me.
So what brought you to this town, this place, and particularly this story?
Yeah, you know, I was doing research about the decline of the steel industry and some efforts at rehabilitation. As you probably know, all along the Mon Valley there, there are these towns that are really shells of them, their former selves, just devastated by economic decline following the decline of the steel industry. So I was doing research in Braddock, Pennsylvania, and this is an iconic mill town. You know, this is home to Andrew Carnegie's first steel mill. The first Carnegie Library is there, and it's just another one of these casualties of the decline of the steel industry. And I was doing research, and a local resident came up to me, and this is a gift for any writer. A local resident comes up to me with a stack of papers, newspaper clippings, things he's put together and written. He says, "You want a story? I got a story for you. 1959, the Braddock High Tigers." And the next day he came back and made sure that I was reading his stuff just in case I was too thick to know that this was a great story.
And this is a team. Let us talk for a moment about these Braddock High Tigers. They went five seasons without losing a game, and they were doing great. So let's start there of what was so tremendous about this team and how the coach, Chuck Klossing, was able to put together such an operation.
Sure. You know, the Tigers, Chuck Klossing in 1959, he's 34 years old. He's a young guy. And this is his sixth season with a team. And they had been a pretty mediocre team before this, a long losing record. It's a mixed race team, which was something of an anomaly at the time. A lot of teams had one or two African-American players on them. But this squad was about half and half, white and black. And a lot of people counted them out for that reason. They thought there was too much tension racially. And Klossing was really this cohesive force. He really brought together the players. And he did it in a number of ways. One is that he was just a disciplinarian. At a former high school, in his first teaching job, there's this great story. Two students out at recess saw him coming, turning the corner, and they had been smoking cigarettes. And so they stuffed the lit cigarettes in their pockets rather than incur one of Klossing's, he was known as a paddler at the time. That's a practice he subsequently stopped, but he would paddle kids. So they put the cigarettes in their pockets, went into class, and a few minutes later, Klossing comes out. There's a fire drill, a fire bell. He asked the teacher, "What happened?" And she said, "My coat room just burst into flames." So that's the kind of discipline we're talking about. And that really, it helped this team meld. But, you know, there are some other ways, too. He was a preparer. He made sure his kids were prepared, and he had some innovative ways of doing that. And he became a stand-in father. This is Western Pennsylvania in the middle of the century, and so you're dealing with a lot of hard men. And among the players, there are lots of stories of physical and emotional abuse from fathers. So Klossing was tough, but he also had this real tender spot for his players. Before each game, he would take them for this big meal at the Elks Club. And this was in the middle of the strike when home-cooked meals were hard to come by. Then they'd go to a movie house, and they'd watch a shoot-'em-up or a cowboy movie, and the coaches would call them out by groups to tape them before the game. So he was a real father figure to these kids.
Well, going into that season, how much pressure was on the coach and ultimately the team?
The strike put tremendous pressure on them. The record they were chasing was set in 1942 by a coach named Paul Brown. And Paul Brown is this heroic figure in football history. He went on to coach the Cleveland Browns. This is a team that's named after him. So they're chasing this great record, And at the start of the season, the town of Braddock is out of work. And this is hard to conceptualize if you haven't been to Western Pennsylvania and haven't seen the borough system of Pennsylvania. But Pennsylvania, in the borough system, you have these small towns, and they're right next to each other, but they feel very isolated because the borough system is very insular. Each town has its own city council, its own mayor, its own fire department, its own police department, and its own school board. So usually there's one high school in these towns, and the high school football team is representing the town. So you have all of these factors, the people out of work who are eating donated food at this point, and looking to the team to really bolster the town in a dark moment. And so I'd say there's tremendous pressure.
And that tremendous pressure brought all kinds of eyes on this team. You write in the book that members of the Pittsburgh Steelers would come and watch these games. Of course, the media was interested in this story. They would come and watch these games. So not only within the town, but it starts to grab headlines as to what is happening in that community.
Yeah, and Clausing, the coach, he was very wary of the publicity. You know, he thought it potentially was this very negative factor. But you're absolutely right. Pittsburgh Steelers would come and watch the games, and they'd be in awe of the spectacle. 10,000 people would turn out on a Friday night in this little town of 16,000. So that's pretty phenomenal. In 1958, the final regular season game against North Braddock, who is Braddock's big rival, the Notre Dame team was present. There's this great story where Notre Dame was in town playing the University of Pittsburgh, and the Fighting Irish coach asked around to friendly residents of Western Pennsylvania, who obviously were Pitt fans, and they kindly told him that, you know, there was only one game this weekend that was going to feature two teams that were worth a damn, and that was in Braddock. So the Fighting Irish watched their games, and as you said, Sports Illustrated and tons of local media. It was a real spectacle, and the eyes of the nation and certainly the region were on Braddock.
This book is so much through his lens and through his perception of what was going on at that time, and I find it really interesting because you say that when you stumbled upon the story and starting out saying, okay, I want to write about this steel town, and then you keep hearing about this guy, well, then this guy's still alive. So then this becomes a great moment for you to talk to him about what happened, and I would think that time and putting it into some perspective gave you an amazing insight into what this meant, not only for the town, but to this man and his life.
Yeah, this is my first book, and I'm so spoiled to have stumbled on this story, really to have had it shoved in my face. I think the reason that the story hadn't been told yet is really because the town of Braddock, you know, going back to this decline, is just such a shell of its former self. So the people that were there have just kind of spread out. You don't have that critical mass anymore, just telling the story over and over and over again. So, by great luck, I stumbled upon it, and Clausing was still alive, and I reached out to him, and he's living in Indiana, Pennsylvania, about an hour away from Braddock. I was in South America at the time. I was writing some stuff about Colombia, so I was doing some research down there. And so we spoke over Skype basically for 3 months straight, just daily, about his life and his perspective. And he was 87 when we started this. And his love for his players, his love for the town, is so evident just in the strength of his memories. I mean, he remembers stuff not only about specific games, which I suspect lots of coaches do, but about the backstories of specific players. And this is a coach who went on to be inducted in the College Football Hall of Fame. I mean, he had a long, illustrious career after Braddock. And during that Hall of Fame induction ceremony, he famously said, you know, a lot of people get up here, they talk about the Rose Bowl, they talk about these fantastic games, these great rivalries in college. For me, it was Friday night against North Braddock. That was the memory. That's the memory that lives on.
What does he make of the book?
He is a fan, I'm so relieved to say, and so happy to say. You know, it wasn't, My task in this was really bringing his vivid memories to life on the page. I was so scared of losing that in translation, because he's such a great storyteller, as are many of the players that I spoke with and many of the residents in Braddock, and just capturing that Western Pennsylvania thing. And it's a thing that's so vibrant, the storytelling, the memories, was my task. So fortunately, he likes it quite a bit.
That's great. One of the things that I think you end the book on this, and I'd like to end here as well, because I think it's just a wonderful way. You tell the story of what happens in the 1950s and how during this horrible time it turned the community, attention to something else. And you note that as you're writing the book, another town in the Mon Valley, the Clarendon High Bears, won 66 consecutive games, and this is something that it was huge, because again it turned the attention to something else as opposed to the hardships that the town was facing.
Yeah, and the key difference there is that the residents of Braddock during the strike, even though the strike ended up going 116 days, so that's almost 4 months without a paycheck. Even though it was protracted and prolonged like that, they knew it was going to end at some point, and they expected that their normal life was going to continue. And steelworkers were very well-paid industrial workers, and these towns, it was a vibrant life. It was a rich life. The difference, of course, is Clarendon today is, much like Braddock today, just devastated. It's a community that's suffering. It's a community that has no strong base. And so the football team, the Clarendon Bears, really did that, much the way that the Tigers did 50 years earlier. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Just a great moment and a great illustration of the power of sport. There's a lot of controversy surrounding football, a lot of well-deserved controversy right now. And I think those moments where you can see the power of the sport also are just so important to highlight.
Art Rooney, Jr., Vice President of the Pittsburgh Steelers, writes, "This is the way a sports book should be written. It is entitled Striking Gridiron, A Town's Pride and a Team's Shot at Glory During the Biggest Strike in American History." The book is published by Thomas Dunn Books. Greg Nichols, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure.
Joe, thank you. Pleasure was mine.
Very nice to have you on the program. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Striking Gridiron, published by St. Martin's Press, Thomas Dunn Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.